Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm Graham Richmond, and this is your wiretaps for Monday, July 7th, 2025. I'm joined by Alex Brown from Cornwall, England. Alex, happy belated 4th of July. I don't know if you celebrate anymore now that you're living in the UK, but it was a long weekend in the US.
So yeah, happy 4th of July. Fantastic. Belated. Tomorrow, right? Because we're recording on.
Yeah, that's true. But what's going on with MBA admissions news and the wires?
Yeah, I mean, we're still not out of the woods yet in terms of, you know, waitlist situations and so forth. So I did actually last week, I saw a bit more of an uptick, I thought anyway, on Livewire with some waitlist activity. So those folks that are still on the waitlist, just hang in there. There's still a lot of uncertainty out there, I presume, related to international students and so forth. So yeah, until you're removed from the waitlist, it's still not over.
Yeah, and I did see that uptick that you talked about. And then I saw some decision wire entries that I wondered if they were brought on by people saying, uh-oh, I don't know where to go now. I've got multiple offers. And so, yeah, just as a reminder, we love getting those entries. So if you do have, you know, if you have all your final decisions in hand, post the decision wire, we love to weigh in on those and just to hear like what sort of dilemmas people are facing and, you know, scholarship dollars, all that stuff. So yeah, I think we're not out of the woods at all. And, you know, I was at the GMAC conference last week. A lot of admissions directors, you know, were pretty transparent about the fact that there's still, you know, maybe as many as a third of their international students who, you know, they don't know yet if they're going to be able to come because of this whole visa situation and the delays. So there could be further movement is what I'm getting at. And we're getting closer and closer to the start of pre-terms and things like that, but there's still some time for movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
So another thing I wanted to just tell everyone who's tuned in is, you know, it'd be great if you could to leave us a review or a rating on this show. That's the best way for people to learn about it. I mean, obviously, if you want to, you can, you know, shout from the rooftops or post on LinkedIn that you love the show. That always helps too. But we're just, you know, need to spread the word. This is that time of year where a new crop of candidates are kind of coming in, joining this community that we love to support. And so if you can spread the word, if you know other applicants or you see them at fairs, just tell them to listen to the show because I think it is a great, you know, we hear over and over again that it's a good resource, but also that folks kind of like having something to tune into once a week as they're traveling through the admissions process. So definitely spread the word if you could.
Yeah, that would be absolutely brilliant. Then we might have two listeners instead of one.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, I have to say, at the GMAC conference, even among admissions professionals, people working in schools, there were a few that said they listened. So I think we have more than two, Alex, now.
Very good.
But speaking of tuning in, this Wednesday on July 9th, I'm going to sit down at noon Eastern with admissions directors from Berkeley, Cornell, Dartmouth, Duke, and Wharton. And I'm going to grill them on their essay topics for this year and, you know, just get all the insider info on what they're looking for, why they ask these questions. So if you're applying to any of those schools, you should definitely sign up. You can do so at bit.ly/MBAEssay0725. We do this every Wednesday in the month of July starting next week. So you'll have further editions on the 16th, 23rd, and 30th of July with a whole bunch of it's I can tell you, it's five schools each week. And we've got a whole bunch of great schools in the weeks that follow too. So please join us for that. Alex, I noticed one thing that, and we're going to talk about this in the webinar, but Berkeley for a long time have had this essay question, which is it's a great question. It's what makes you feel alive and why? And it's just a short essay where you're supposed to talk about something you do that you really enjoy. That is no longer going to be an essay this year. I noticed when I was getting ready to do this webinar that that's now a video response. And I'm wondering, is that going to be the way of the future as schools try to get at the authentic candidate and not maybe the ChatGPT authored response or something? I don't know. But I just noted that as I was going through and prepping.
Yeah, no, I think that's really super interesting and definitely a good query to put to Berkeley Haas in terms of why they made that change.
Oh yeah, that's the first question I have for them. So we're going to find out on Wednesday. In other kind of MBA related news, here in Paris or in the suburbs of Paris, HEC have a big overhaul planned for their campus. They're going to spend $267 million US dollars to kind of overhaul their you know, they have kind of an undergraduate business school. They have the MBA program, some other offerings as well, executive education. They're basically kind of redoing their campus. It looks like I saw some of the renderings, the architectural renderings. It looks pretty impressive. So you can read all about that on our website. We also did an article about all the key events to check out in person in July. So Christina on our team, basically, she goes school by school. And if that school is traveling or doing any kind of in-person event, whether it's a fair or just a one-off, it's in this calendar. So really useful. I look to see if any of them are coming to Paris. And I think there was only one school that's doing something in Paris. But you know, they're hitting all kinds of places all around the world. So it's a good rundown. And we do that every month at the beginning of the month.
Very good.
We also did a couple of admissions tips. We had one about how to apply to business school as a younger applicant. And we also continue to run these Mythbusters. So I really liked this week's. We did two of them. One is over 30s need not apply to top MBAs. Very relevant. I don't know if you did this on purpose, Alex, but we have a couple of older candidates we're going to talk about in the wiretaps portion of the show this week. And then the other one was successful professionals need not get an MBA. So like if you're doing well at work, you don't need an MBA. So you can read those two to learn why those are patently false statements, but a lot of fun. And, you know, again, kudos to you, Alex, for coming up with the idea to sort of ask ChatGPT for kind of new content, you know, series. And this Mythbusters one has been fun.
Yeah, yeah. No, very good. And yeah, again, using ChatGPT, not to write the articles, but to come up with concept ideas and stuff. I think that's a really good use case.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting. You've got two articles here, one focusing on the younger candidates and so forth and what they need to do, as well as one focusing on older candidates and whether they should apply. So yeah. I imagine if you end up reading both, you'll get a nice spectrum of perspective. But clearly top schools seek out, you know, all candidates as long as they can convince the ADCOM why now is the right time. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, correct for an early bird, a younger candidate, and that's correct for a more mature candidate.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we'll talk about it a little bit with some of our candidates this week, I think. To connect with admissions directors. You know, this is that time of year where we do our admissions director Q&A series. I saw a lot of these folks out at the GMAC conference, but we have these nice articles with interviews on the site. We did one with Katie Radal, who is at UNC Kenan Flagler. She's the admissions director there. And we asked her for a tip on essay writing, and she gave a very simple kind of piece of advice, but I thought it was worth sharing here. She said, my biggest piece of advice, and it sounds simple, is to answer the question. Too often, we reach the end of an essay and still don't have a clear sense of what happened or what the outcome was. We craft our prompts intentionally to gather specific insights and context. We read thousands of essays each year, so it's important to bring your authentic voice to each response. Be clear, be reflective, and help us understand your story. We're truly excited to get to know you. So that was Katie's advice. I think it's good advice. I mean, I really do sometimes.
It's good advice. And quite frankly, when I was at Wharton, that was an easy way to deny a candidate.
Yeah.
Right? If you don't answer each element of the prompt, you're in the you know, you're not in the pile you want to end up being in.
Yeah. And actually, yeah. What we tell people to do sometimes is take an essay you've written and give it to a friend and ask them to tell you what the question was after they've read it.
Yeah.
In any event, we also caught up with Naz Erenguk. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She is the director of admissions at University of Florida, the Warrington College of Business. They have a very small MBA program. It's like 35 students each year, super intimate. It's like one cohort, basically. And we asked her about their interview process. We just say, can you tell us a little bit about how it works and, you know, who conducts the interviews, et cetera. And I'm sharing this because they have a kind of unusual process, which I think speaks to the small kind of size. But she says that they do all their interviews via Zoom. They're 1 hour long, and they're split between the admissions team and one of their career services officers. Okay, and she said that an applicant spends the first portion of the meeting with either her or someone on the admissions team talking about why they're interested in the MBA, professional and personal goals. And she says, you know, that they ask them questions to provide, to shed light on how well a candidate works in groups and teams. Then she says, we also ask situational questions on topics about leadership, conflict resolution, stress management, But then the second portion of the interview covers topics related to career objectives, what type of companies and roles the candidate's interested in. We also ask questions that provide, that shed light on the coachability and grit that the student possesses. So I just thought I would share her remarks there because it's interesting. I don't know of a school that does it that way, where you've got kind of a career services person and an admissions person taking part in that interview.
I think it's a really interesting model.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because you don't want to obviously admit a candidate who sounds wonderful, but it turns out that their career plan is not something they can execute on at that university. Mm-hmm. I think this makes quite a lot of sense, and especially for a program that's more intimate, a little bit smaller, et cetera, they absolutely want to make sure they get it right in terms of bringing in the right candidate for their program.
Yeah, totally. Could not agree more. Anyway, I just thought it was really interesting. So and it was great to catch up with both Naz and Katie at the GMAT conference last week. Little did they know we were going to talk about them on the show this week. We also caught up with, I think we're kind of coming to an end on this, but we're still running some of those alumni profiles as part of our Real Humans alumni series. So we caught up with Faye, who's a Yale grad from the MBA program back in 23. She's currently a program manager at Google. She's 34 now, from Brooklyn, New York originally. And she went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where she studied American politics and French studies. She worked for the New York City Department of Education for about 6 years prior to going off to business school. So kind of a non-traditional candidate. And we asked her, well, why did you go to Yale? What led you to make the decision to attend there? And she said, first, I was attracted to the dual mission of Yale SOM, developing leaders for business and society. My, quote, society background is important to me, and I wanted to attend a school that would A, value my experience, B, attract students who share my values, all while C, pushing me beyond my comfort zone. Second, New Haven also appealed to me. I knew I wanted a small city where most students would not have an existing network, which provides a forcing function to build community. Finally, I knew I wanted to return to New York City after graduation, so I thought that staying on the East Coast would make sense. So that's Faye's kind of rationale for heading off to Yale. And I thought it was just really good to see how she thought that through.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. The second point, I mean, we even make that second point for Wharton, right? I mean, basically everybody comes to Wharton rather than already having existing networks in Philadelphia. But this, I've never heard that term, forcing function.
Yeah.
So that's going into my vocabulary. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah. So in any event, very good stuff. I'm sure that Yale could, you know, read that and think, hey, this is a nice little marketing pitch for our program. But in any event, yeah. So the only other thing I wanted to mention is that, speaking of, like, you know, my interactions with schools at the conference, and I'm thinking back even to our MBA fair, we've had a lot of touch points with admissions directors, and I've been out there recording bits of audio. And so starting actually this week, we're going to release audio from the MBA fair in Boston. We did some panels there. We had admissions directors from, you know, Dartmouth, Harvard, Duke, MIT, UCLA, Yale. There were a handful of others, Columbia. The others are escaping right now. But anyway, we connected with a lot of them as we did these panels about, like, what is an MBA? We did two different panels on admissions tips. And Dennis, our producer, engineer extraordinaire, has worked these up into episodes, like mini episodes of the show. So those are going to air starting this week. And then while I was in Kansas City at the GMAT conference, I kind of hung out with a lot of admissions directors and convinced some of them to sort of step into a little foyer and answer a question that you helped me develop, Alex. And the question was, why is the MBA a valuable degree in tumultuous times, you know, times of economic uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, and even technological upheaval? So we'll get those clips together. We're still trying to figure out how we want to work them in, whether they'll be part of this show, you know, the kind of Wiretap show, or maybe just a standalone episode about the value of an MBA. But that's forthcoming too. So I'm really looking forward to that.
No, absolutely. Really terrific content coming.
Yeah. And let's see, I think that's all I had. Obviously, if people want to write to us, you can write to info@clearadmit.com. Use the subject line Wiretaps. Otherwise, Alex, I'm ready to talk about the candidates that you picked out for this week.
Yeah, let's kick on.
All right. So this is Wiretaps candidate number one. Our first candidate this week has 5 schools on the target list. They want to start in the fall of 26. The schools that they're looking at are Columbia, Harvard, Kellogg, Chicago, and Wharton. This person's an entrepreneur. They actually founded a company in the e-commerce space, and they're looking to use business school to make a pretty substantial pivot into investment banking. So they mentioned Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and some others as potential targets post-MBA. They have a whopping 335 on the GRE and a 3.8 undergraduate GPA, so very strong numbers. They've been working for 8 years now, and they indicate in their note to us that they're trying to make this career transition from running their own e-commerce business to corporate finance or investment banking. They think that an MBA is going to give them, you know, the technical foundation and the recruiting path to be able to do that, since they're now 8 years out from undergrad. They definitely want to go to business school now. They feel like their business has hit sort of an inflection point, they say, and they're ready to make a career change. So, Alex, what do you make of this? It's kind of unusual to see someone going from entrepreneurship into investment banking, slightly older candidate, but stellar numbers. So what's your take here?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, this is quite an unorthodox sort of plan. Getting the MBA given the plan makes perfect sense, so I'm not dismissing that. I mean, I think the MBA is a natural transition for a candidate like this. But yeah, apparently super successful entrepreneur running a viable e-commerce business over a good period of time, wanting to switch to the finance side of business effectively, right? And learn, and doing that by getting the MBA, doing that hardcore investment banking, and then moving on from there. I'd really like to get a bit more of a clearer sense of their long-term plan and goal post-investment banking. I think that would help add some clarity. Obviously, another key component will be the success of this e-commerce business that they've run for a significant period of time, and some of the bumps along the road and what they've learned from those bumps, et cetera, et cetera. So that could really help, you know, in terms of make for a very interesting candidacy, right? So their impact and growth, not just themselves, but the business more generally and so forth, that would be very good. One of the things that they're going to have to consider is their choice of recommenders.
Yes.
I think as an entrepreneur, this is really, really important, right? So you know, whether they've got a co-founder, I believe they're planning to use a co-founder as a recommender. And they mentioned that they were going to use an employee as a second recommender who reported into them. And I'm just not sure that would be the right choice, Graham. Maybe they've got to look for a mentor or an advisor or someone that's sort of provided service to the business that has interaction with them over a long period of time. But the choice of recommenders will be important. As you said, their numbers are outstanding. So if that's married to a reasonably successful e-commerce business, et cetera, then yeah, they're targeting M7, but they realistically probably should be targeting some of the very top. I know before we came on air, you mentioned that maybe they need to take a closer look at Stern and Cornell. And I know your rationale for that was, well, they're just great places to transition into investment banking.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, I'm glad you brought up the recommendations question, because I think it's an important one. I feel like it is a big pivot that they're trying to make. I think it's doable, but I would maybe cast a slightly wider net and look at the Cornells and Sterns of the world for that express reason that they can, you know, give you a pathway into banking. I worry that they don't have their head in the right place with the recs yet. You know, picking a co-founder in of itself could be controversial because they're really a peer. And then if the second rec comes from an employee, then neither rec is really providing what the schools are looking for, which is an objective senior point of view. And I recognize as an entrepreneur, that's really challenging. But most entrepreneurs will go to, if they raised funds, then someone who invested in the firm, or if they have a big client who's objective and can give a kind of assessment. Ideally, you know, you're picking someone at a client who's older than you and very senior. Or another thing, as you, I think, suggested earlier here, is you go and you look at someone that's provided service, whether it's your firm's lawyer or accountant, someone, again, ideally older than you, more seasoned, who can comment critically on your ability to lead an organization. So I would strongly encourage them to think about those recs. And I think if they went to the schools would tell them exactly the same thing. So that's important. The other thing they did shed some light on is that they are active outside of work. They play rec sports like basketball. It's unclear if they have any sort of concrete outside activities or concerted sort of involvement in something, but that would be good to know as well. Again, some of these things are minor, but they make the difference between, like you're saying, an M7 candidacy and maybe something a little further afield. So I encourage them to really flesh it out. And I think you were also pressuring them a little bit to think about what's the long-term plan. And they seem to have that when you push them. They gave us a little bit more information about private equity and stuff. So, yeah, so there's a lot to think about here. I love the numbers. I mean, this is a strong candidate, but they are older and they're trying to make a big pivot. And so they need to be careful, especially on the recs.
You called it a triple jump, Graham. What do you mean by that? Well, you didn't call it on air when you were preparing.
Yeah, so actually, I guess technically it might only be a double because I don't think they're changing geography. I don't know if we know exactly where they are right now, but if they're in New York and they want to stay in New York, then they're not moving geography, but they're certainly moving industry and function. So normally, yeah, the triple jump would be all three. But yeah, it's a big jump no matter how you slice it. And I mean, there is a little part of me wondering, like, do the banks like taking someone who's 30 plus years old when they know that these are kind of grueling jobs and maybe they want to, you know, give them to the younger candidates who they can work to the bone. So that is another issue. That's why they need to come in with a really, you know, clear-eyed view on what they want and go after it.
Yeah, very good.
All right. I want to thank them for sharing their profile and hopefully some of this advice helps them to find success. Let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number two. So our second candidate this week has six schools on the target list and is also hoping to start in the fall of 26. They've got Kellogg, Booth, Foster, UCLA Anderson, USC Marshall, and UT Austin McCombs on the list. They have 4.5 years work experience as a Big Four tax consultant and also 4 years at an HR tech startup. That's their current role, where they manage global mobility and immigration operations. So they have over 8 years of experience. Post-MBA, they're still sort of trying to figure it out, but they do mention tech or commercial banking. They also just indicated they're not really sure. They have a 312 on the GRE. They have a 3.84 undergraduate GPA. 8.5 years, as I said, of work experience. They're located in Seattle, and they're thinking that their main target is Foster at University of Washington, but they will also consider several other high-reach schools. And some of this, they say, depends on a retake of the GRE that they have planned. They're thinking, though, that they're going to apply to Foster in round one or two, and they're wondering what their chances would be if they were to apply without a GRE score. And they say that they took it a few months ago and have that 312, but they're currently studying and they're hoping to retake next month. And they're just sort of wondering, like, what happens if they don't hit the mark? Like, they're trying to get 320 plus, but if they don't, they're wondering, is there like a cutoff where you'd say, you know what, just apply without the score? They also did share that they're male, 31, domestic US candidate of Middle Eastern descent, lower income upbringing. They went to undergrad at DePaul and majored in finance and accounting. They did graduate magna cum laude, so pretty good undergraduate numbers. And they did have a CPA license when they were working in the Big Four. That's obviously since expired, but I think they're mentioning that because of the fact that if you don't have a GRE or GMAT score, you might need to demonstrate, you know, kind of abilities elsewhere. So what's your take here, Alex?
Yeah, I wouldn't question this candidate's abilities. A 3.84 GPA and the type of work experience they have seems, pretty strong, right? Seems strong. So, But the 312 GRE is definitely hurts their overall profile. So get the retake done, and hopefully the retake then correlates more with a 384 GPA, i.e. get that GRE into those 320s where it would appear to belong. and so forth. The other thing that I'm a little concerned with is this sort of wishy-washy sort of goal stuff. Again, older candidates, so I'm sure this, you know, one of our admissions tips this week when talking about the older candidates, one of the things that they'll talk about is if you're an older candidate, you really should have a better developed plan and so forth. And that why now, why MBA, really well developed. So I'm a bit concerned that might signal to ADCOM that, you know, maybe they're getting an MBA to reinvent themselves, don't really know what they're doing. So they don't want to come across like that at all. They want to come across as someone that has a really well forward-thinking plan, and the MBA is a great stepping stone now in their career to pursue that plan. So really ratchet up the goals and try to get this GRE score to correlate better with the GPA. But Graham, the reason why I picked this candidate, other than sort of all the other stuff we talked about, is this idea of waiving the GRE versus representing the GRE score, and what are the risks to both approaches? So obviously, if they move this GRE score up a little bit, and let's say they hit that sort of 320 and so forth, we would argue that it makes more sense to present it and in complement with the GPA, they're offering more data points to the ADCOM, so that's very good. And quite frankly, some of the schools on their target list would require the test score anyway, right? So I assume Kellogg and Booth, for example. So the risks to waiving are going to limit your school choices and providing less data points, right? Yeah. So there is a risk to that approach. But I assume more and more candidates are looking at potentially waiving if they don't have the median test score. So schools have allowed this sort of situation to develop, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, I mean, so I think for Foster, where they allow for waivers, I think, you know, this person could probably make a pretty strong case. I mean, they had a stellar GPA, they worked at a big four, they were, you know, had a CPA license. So they tick a lot of those boxes that you might be worried about. It's not like they were an art history major working, you know, in the arts world or something, right? So they, you know, they tick some of these boxes and could probably get away with it. But as you correctly point out, some of the other schools on their list that require the test, it's going to be a non-starter. I think, you know, clearly we're not, when we get into things like money, scholarships, like sometimes it's better to have a score, especially if the score is high. And part of me feels like, wait, this person's, you know, 3.84 GPA. They're clearly very smart. They studied finance and accounting. I mean, they should be able to do really well on the GRE if they, you know, take a prep course, whatever they need to do. So I certainly want to make sure that they're like putting their best foot forward, as you like to say. It's like, you know, only apply with your best self. And so, we talked about this, I think, in a recent episode about how even admissions directors will say, yeah, we allow you to waive, but you know, if you waive, you're depriving us of another data point. So that's the issue here. And yeah, and as you said earlier, I cannot emphasize enough, they need to figure out their career plan, because there's nothing worse than an older candidate coming into a program who doesn't know what they want. I mean, you know, they say, oh, maybe tech, maybe corporate finance, or maybe a leadership development program, and they need to figure out what they want to do. My advice to them is, for now, buckle down, do your prep course, get the test done again, and hopefully you hit that mark 320 plus and can be competitive with these other numbers, you know, across the board at your schools. And yeah, if it's a disaster and you don't get it up above 315, then maybe you pivot to a plan B and you focus on Foster with your with a waiver or something. But it's tricky. I mean, there are some other schools on the list, I think, that would allow them to waive, so they could continue to keep those in play as well. But yeah, this is not an easy thing. And the way that you're right, the schools have kind of created this issue a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, basically we're seeing median test scores going up. Why is that? Because those at the lower end of the range are no longer taking the test.
Yeah.
It's like, therefore your median will slide up. So it looks good on the admissions stats.
Yeah,
but maybe Graham, what we need to do is write an admissions tip. Should I waive the GMAT or should I waive the test?
Yeah, we have a tip.
Because I don't
think we have one that's about that a little bit, I think, but we can go back and look at it. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, I think not only are the averages going up for the GMAT, I would say, but I think what also happened is you have the GRE averages not really matching up with the GMAT averages. So there's a lot of kind of funny stuff happening with these tests, and it's unfortunate. But anyway, I do want to thank this person for sharing their profile. My advice to them, as I say, is take the test again, do as well as you possibly can, and get your goals. Develop a plan. You don't need to stick to it. Everyone, you know, pivots and modifies when they get into business school. That's very common. But have a plan for the admissions process when it comes to your goals that you can stick to while you're applying.
That you're quite interested into, I would argue.
Yes, it always makes it better. Yes, yeah. For sure.
Don't just come up with one that just seems logical. Find something that you can get yourself behind and be passionate about, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. All right, I want to thank them for their post. Let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number 3. So our third candidate this week is a little bit younger, so just 4 years of work experience instead of 8+, like we had with the first two. They have 8 schools on their target list, and I'm just going to say it's the M7 plus UVA Darden. So they're applying to very top schools. They want to start in the fall of 26, like our other two candidates this week. They've been working as a software engineer. That's their pre-MBA career. And they're thinking about either entrepreneurship, technology, or maybe even venture capital after business school. They have a 3.94 undergraduate GPA. They are located in the US. They have a 710 on the GMAT. So that's the older version of the test before they changed it up. And so that's why it ends in a 0 and not a 5. It's also a score of 710 that's a little below the average at the schools that they're applying to, even in some cases by 20 or 30 points. They do mention that they would have 4 years of experience by the time they matriculate. So right now they're really just at 3. And they've had one promotion, it looks like. They're a subject matter expert in a few different areas. They've had some internal recognition at their firm. And again, they're a software engineer. They said they should have a strong recommendation from their company. They do a bunch of extracurricular activities. The one that jumped out at me, and I think you as well, is it looks like they do quite a bit of coaching, captaining, and managing at a cultural dance academy. They've been doing this for many years. And they first were a student, then a dancer, and then a captain. And so they're really active in this domain. And I think it's an interesting one that you'll comment on, Alex. They did say they went to a top 30 university, top 5 public, and they held positions while they were an undergraduate as well. So they were active, I guess, is the main message there. And they had a high GPA, as I pointed out earlier. They indicate they're going to do the best they can on the essays, and they're hoping that offsets their GMAT score. They may attempt to retake the test in early August, but they want us to consider the 710 as their highest score as we kind of assess things. So what do you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, again, you pointed this out before we came on air. A 710 GMAT is an older test score, so they've had some time to potentially retake. And again, in the back of the ADCOM's mind, that's what they may be thinking. So I would recommend that if they can, to do that retake in August as they consider that as a potential thing to do. And as you pointed out, just make sure there's real clarity in the goal focus. So that will always improve an overall profile if we've got a really good forward-thinking plan, why MBA, etc. So they've had 4 years of experience. They should have thought long and hard about where they want to be in the future and so forth. So, you know, I think some of the things that they talk about make a lot of sense, but let's make it a cogent sort of pathway that's ambitious as well as realistic as well as impactful and so forth. As you pointed out, I love the sort of the software engineering on the one side and the dance school impact on the other side, right? So it's showing some real breadth there. And as a software engineer, it appears that they're going to be able to show really good impact at work, supported by strong recommendations. And they have a 3.94 GPA as an engineer, so that's ridiculous. in a good sense, right? So that's absolutely brilliant. So you know, there's a lot to like here, I think, overall. And you know, if they can bump that GMAT score just up a little bit, freshen the score a little bit, have some good goal focus, make that YMBA really make a lot of sense. I got to say that I like this candidacy, Graham.
Yeah, so I'm going to, just to play devil's advocate, like the downside for me is software engineer. So the dance part's cool, right? But software engineer in of itself is a common profile that we see in the pool. You know, there are a lot of like Indian software engineers who apply to business school. And the GMAT score is low, right? 710. So, and it's older, like you said. So for me, I worry about them getting put into this bucket of like overrepresented and lower score, which could be bad, right? Whereas the GPA is stellar, right? So if this person had a 750 on the GMAT or whatever the equivalent is on the current test, probably like a 705 or, you know, whatever it would be, 695, that would really change the way I look at this. And I did, just from reading, I kind of wondered, like, they didn't say, they say they live in the US, and I presume they went to school in the US for undergrad because they didn't say otherwise. But I sort of wondered, like, where's this person from? Like, did they, you know, did they immigrate from, maybe they're from India or from a market that's overrepresented originally? So they didn't comment on that. Or maybe they're just, you know, Joe, white guy or gal in the US. I have no idea. But those pieces do kind of come into play when it comes to whether or not they're going to be viewed as overrepresented or underrepresented. And so that's where the test score starts to hurt. You know, I would love to have a higher test score here. And particularly because they've had time to like work on it, like you pointed out. I mean, that 710 is probably from at least 2 years ago. So I would love for them to take the test again, which it sounds like they're going to do, hit it out of the park, and then fine, I'm fine with this list of target schools, et cetera. If they are going into the process with the 710 and this profile, I might, you know, not just look at M7 plus Dart, and I might cast a slightly wider net. So that's why where this all comes into play.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. When you cast a wider net, maybe like Ross or one or two others from that top 16 would come into play.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So,
and if they are potentially overrepresented, then they've got to think about that for the first round, right? To overcome the sort of overrepresentation.
Yeah.
So yeah, they got to maybe pivot a little bit on that school selection quite quickly.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, this is a broader conversation we can have another time, but, you know, I know we're now in an era where a lot of these things are not supposed to be taken into account, you know, ethnicity, you know, it's meant to be really blind, but I still think that it does play a role because they're trying to mix together a class that's diverse. And, you know, at the margins, a lot of these candidates, there are many more qualified candidates than there are spots for these classes. So schools still have a bit of leeway to kind of mix things the way they want. So in any event, just something to think about. I do want to thank them for sharing their profile and wish them the best of luck as they head off to retake the test. Alex, thanks for picking all of these out. I think we tackled a number of interesting subjects today with these three candidates across the board, whether it's waivers or who to get to write your letters or how to handle an older candidacy, etc. So thanks a lot for, as always, picking out some great candidates to discuss.
Very good. Stay safe, everyone. Take care.